The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Blue Cliff Record, K78. 16 bodhisattvas going to bathe. Main case. In olden times, there were 16 bodhisattva nuns. When it was time for them to wash, the bodhisattvas filed in to bathe. Suddenly they awakened to the basis of water. All of you chan worthies, how will you understand their saying? Subtle feeling reveals illumination, and we have achieved the station of daughters of Buddha. To realize this, you too must be extremely piercing and penetrating. The verse, I only need one clear-eyed student who understands this matter. Stretch out your legs on the long bench and lie down. In a dream, you once spoke of awakening to perfect pervasiveness. Though you've washed in fragrant water, I'll spit right in your face. This is actually is taken from the Surangama Sutra, which is an important sutra in the Mahayana. And there's a section where there are 25 accounts by different bodhisattvas of how they came to enlightenment, and this is one of them. The spokesperson for that group says, when it was time to bathe, we followed the custom and entered the bathhouse. Suddenly, upon contact with the water, I understood that the water was neither washing away the dirt nor washing my body. In the midst of this, I became tranquil, as I understood there was nothing there. The Buddha asked how we broke through to enlightenment. I believe that the contemplation of tangible objects is the best method. I was thinking about koan, much of the teaching style in the Zen tradition, which is direct pointing, and how there are so many aspects of teachings that, as the talk I gave during the Fasatsu on Friday about the judging mind, that is related to how we conduct ourselves, our speech, our thoughts, our actions, the karma of that, the precepts, how we can practice, doing metta practice, cultivating compassion, all of these really essential and deep aspects of Buddhist practice. And an important aspect of that is, in a certain sense, their accessibility, right? These things, anybody can really understand. They can be presented in a language that, speaks to anybody, whether they're Buddhist or not. I mean, largely, they're things that we can sort of immediately put into practice. They seem relatively graspable, to follow the precepts, to do metta practices. And in that way, they're very important for that reason and for everything else that they do and that they bring forth within us, which is to really open our hearts and to bring us into contact with each other, to help us understand the consequences of our actions, to learn how to be more skillful with ourselves and others. It's just, we can't practice without this. I think of the first paramita, dana, that it said that the first paramita of giving is the first paramita because everyone can do that, right? In a way, it's not that difficult. Everyone understands that language. In a sense, a lot of these teachings that I'm referring to are like that, in the sense, it doesn't mean they're always easy, right? But that they have an accessibility. The wisdom teachings are more difficult by nature because they're pointing to the ground of our nature, the ground of our being, to that which actually can't be touched. It's not tangible in that sense. That those other aspects are using our thoughts, using our understanding, using ideas and concepts, and translating them into teachings and practices. This is different. In a sense, that's why the two aspects of compassion and wisdom are so essential. They work together. that for our wisdom to be true wisdom, it has to be engaged, it has to be active, it actually has to be making a difference. In order for compassion to be fully compassionate, arising out of selflessness and wisdom, there needs to be wisdom. And so this is one of the koans, and much of the teaching in Zen is really always often pointing and bringing us to that ground. And within that larger body of teachings that is often teaching of compassion and the precepts and so on, that those teachings also are intended from within the Buddhist tradition to bring us to that ground. Recognizing that that's not going to happen. You know, we can't just be living a chaotic, destructive life and expect to enlighten our mind. That it all has to work together. But that is the reason I wanted to bring that up. I thought of that with this koan, because the koans, there's an aspect in which they are, you know, difficult. More difficult to understand, because in a way they're not speaking so directly to that logical aspect of our mind that is going to figure something out. We're not going to figure wisdom out. Even if we understand it well and understand it correctly, that's just understanding of a certain kind. And so when we talk about enlightenment as revealing, illuminating what has seemed to be dark, revealing what has seemed to be hidden, to realize the self, the nature of the self is empty, and to realize the nature of phenomena. It's very important, particularly in Mahayana Buddhism, right? Because we're relating to and dealing with the world of things all the time, everywhere. And so the idea that I could just realize and liberate myself from self-clinging and false views, and then that's going to immediately translate into the world where I still see the world and the world of things as being independently existing, separate, distinct, having intrinsic qualities and attributes and power, then they still have power. So realizing self of the reality, the true nature of self and phenomena. And so here, I believe that the contemplation of tangible objects is the best method. And by tangible objects, let's just include everything, right? Emotions, beliefs, relationships, governments, physical objects, a cup, a tree, a bridge, a gun, $100 bill, a thought, an emotion, sensation, the whole, anything we can experience. So how do we understand the selflessness of things? So one of the classic analogies or metaphors that was used was of a chariot. So most of us haven't done much chariot riding, so let's think in terms of a bicycle, right? There's a bicycle. You see it, that's a bicycle. But so to examine it from the point of view, it's just like, here's a person. Right, I experience myself as a person. This is who I am. I am Shugen. I am a monk. I am a man. Those are the things that I am. The verb to be establishes a sense of solidity, of intrinsicness. This is what I am. And so a bicycle is just a bicycle, right? And so the examination is, okay, let's take it apart. So we have spokes and rims and tube and tire and ball bearings and frame and seat and so on. And they're all scattered on the ground. Is it still a bicycle? Would you walk up and say, oh, that's a bicycle? Or would we more likely say, oh, those are all the parts of a bicycle. There's a seat, there's the handlebars, there's the brake. And so let's reassemble it. At what point, as we start adding piece by piece, does it become a bicycle again? Is the self just a combination of parts? And how many of those parts are essential to it being a self? So when somebody is aging and they're having dementia or Alzheimer's and we can't, or with Yukon, with aphasia, and we're not able to communicate, right? Is the person still there, right? Having lost this really central aspect of how we identify each other and sort of like, oh, that's how I know it's Yukon. That's how I know it's you. because we can tell the same stories, we can share certain sort of, you know, trajectories of history and so on. What happens when that gets disrupted? And so that example is used to point to the, to sort of help us examine and not just take it at face value, that this is a bicycle is a word that describes something. What does it describe? From a Buddhist perspective, it describes a combination of parts. And if you take one of those parts, a rim, a tube, a seat, well, you can do the same thing to that. You can dismantle that into all of its constituent parts. And then you can do that with all of it, those constituent parts. And what the Buddha realized in his enlightenment is that there's no moment at which we will reach something that just exists by itself and is non-reducible. And it's not even so much reducible in a reductive sense, but is not the result of other composite parts. That's what we call the skandhas, the aggregate. So when we chant the Heart Sutra, which is one of perhaps considered the most important sutra in Mahayana Buddhism, form is emptiness, emptiness is form, sensation, conception, perception, discrimination and awareness, that's the seat, the frame, the rims, the spokes of us. There's something there. They're all the parts. Put together, it's a bike. You can ride it. Put together, it's a person. But what is the nature of his existence? That's when we talk about the ground of being. That's what these wisdom teachings are pointing to. Because that's what the Buddha realized was the ultimate liberation. I mean, remember, all that he did leading up to his enlightenment, he was doing these very profound spiritual practices and accomplishing to a very profound degree. In other words, he was having all kinds of experiences, was training his mind, was able to experience deep states of meditation. But he knew that he was not yet fully liberated, right? Because all of that stuff was dependent upon what he was doing. And he realized as long as we're dependent, our liberation is dependent on something I have done, it's going to come apart. It's not reliable. And so here in this koan, these bodhisattva nuns were awakened to the nature, the basis of water. A very simple, essential element. And so we can look at water in a, you know, as a poet, as a naturalist, ecologist, as a scientist. I was thinking of Bill Bryson in his book, A Short History of Nearly Everything. And he talked about water as being remarkable. He said it's everywhere. We're 65% water. Cows are 74% water, which is kind of weird, right? Because they're so big. You think they'd be less water, right? Tomatoes, 95% water. Watermelons, probably 99% water. Right? And most liquids contract when they cool, but not water. Water expands, right? Which is why it floats, which is very convenient, right? Because otherwise it would sink. And floating helps to keep the oceans from freezing. We can't live without water. It says after a few days, our lips vanish, our skin contracts so much we can't blink. And yet most of the water on the earth we can't drink. It's poisonous to us because it's salty. And yet our water is salty. He says we cry seawater, we sweat seawater, and the proportions of the salt in our bodily water is almost exactly the same as the oceanic water. Is that an accident? And yet if we have too much salt in our water, that doesn't work. The hydrogen atoms, he says, cling fiercely to their oxygen hosts, but they also are constantly exchanging with other water molecules, billions of times a second, which is why water has a cohesiveness. So when we siphon it, we can siphon water. It holds together, right? But it's not so held together that when you dive into a pool, it's like concrete. It lets you in. It's amazing. So there are lots of ways we can look at water, think about water, marvel at water, be grateful for water. We can also just have a drink or go into wash. Buddhism is concerned with, you know, in a sense, appreciating all of that, and is concerned with all that goes wrong with water, with something so similar that we are made of. The elements of us, the objects that we live in the midst of, that we relate to every day, each other. If everything abides within its own Dharma state and is complete unto itself and is in a sense perfectly brought into this world, its world, and as most living things do, know how to live in harmony, what's up with us? And so that was the Buddha's search. That's what he wanted to understand. We get old, we get sick, we die. Everything is like that. Why do we fret so? Everything experiences discomfort. Why, when we experience discomfort, do we so often take it out on others? Why, with the majesty of our consciousness, do we turn so much of that into destruction? I was just reading, talking to somebody at breakfast, reading an article this week about how China, Russia, and the United States are all gearing up to be able to have wars in space. What an incredible idea. Untapped. We never thought about that. Oh my God, we could have wars in space. We've been missing that all along. What? And the article was just like, yes, this is necessary, this is inevitable, of course we have to do this. Master Dogen writes about water in the Mountains and Rivers Sutra. He says, water is neither strong nor weak. It's not wet or dry. It's neither moving nor still. It's not hot nor cold. It's neither being nor non-being. It's neither delusion nor enlightenment. Solidified, it's harder than diamond. Who could break it? Melted, it's softer than milk. Who could break it? This being so, we cannot doubt the many virtues realized by water. We should then study that occasion when the water of the 10 directions is seen in the 10 directions. This is not a study only of the time when people or gods see water. There is a study of water seeing water. Water practices and verifies water. Hence, there is a study of water speaking water. We must bring in realization, to realization, the path on which the self encounters the self. We must move back and forth along and spring off from the vital path on which the other studies and fully comprehends the other. So what kind of craziness is this? Water sees water. Water practices and verifies water. Study the occasion when the water of the 10 directions is seen in the 10 directions. Being locked in this self, in this sense of self, this is who I am. I am. Water is closed off to me. I can appreciate it. I'm 65% of me is water. But I can't know water. Because I'm not water. And to even speak of being water is ludicrous. Because this is who I am. So Dogen is looking. I believe that the contemplation of tangible objects is the best method. How do we contemplate something so miraculous and ordinary as water? So Dogen invites us in. Ultimately, he says, we must bring to realization the path on which the self encounters the self. How do we directly and intimately encounter ourself? We speak of knowing ourself, speaking our truth, being true to ourself. What is this self? What is true? We have to be careful about that. When we talk about in terms of what is truth in Buddhism, it sounds like something that's very tangible. It is an absolute. The Dharma is not spoken of as the truth. We can speak of it as true in the sense that if we live in accord with it, our life is in accord. That which is not true is that which is not in accord with reality. But the truth becomes precarious. Because if Buddhism knows the truth, what about every other tradition? We got a problem. Water is neither strong nor weak, neither wet nor dry. It's not this or that. This or that, wet or dry, moving or still, those are all observations. We're observing water in different states. We can do that. But in doing that, we solidify, we objectify, we make absolute the thing that we see. And so we could just do the same thing. This self is not my body. It's not sensations. It's not my perceptions. It's not my ideas and opinions. It's not my awareness. We can say those are constituent aspects of the self, but none of those things are the self. And so Buddhist practice says, take up any one of those aspects as a meditation and examine with your non-thinking mind, with the strength of your developed awareness, so we strengthen that in our sitting, and see if you can find yourself, a self, in your body, in a moment of perception, in an idea. The self is neither seeing, nor hearing, nor tasting, nor touching, smelling, or thinking. Those are things that happen, that are done, but not done by the self. The self is not born, it doesn't die, it's not small or large, it's not young or old, it's not you, but it's not apart from you. And so what we discover in practice is to discover one true thing, or to discover what is true about one thing, water, the self. We kind of have to relinquish much of what we think about it, even if what we think about it is true. So you can be a scientist, you can know everything there is to know about water. Wonderful. But to enter into the study of water, to get to its ground, in a sense, to liberate, not water, water doesn't have a problem, to liberate our mind in relationship to water, to establish a right relationship. We have to let go of the ideas we have about water, even if they're correct. That doesn't mean to not have them, use them when they're useful, but in our meditation, because if we have the idea, that's what we're sitting with. We're just reaffirming what we already know, which is an idea. It's not water itself. That's what Dogen is saying. So we have to relinquish that, which we develop the capacity to do during our meditation, and experience it directly. Awaken to the basis of water. Subtle feeling reveals illumination. And so practice is very simply and naturally returning, helping us to return to this original state, realizing the basis. Subtle feeling reveals, brings forth illumination. What was dark is now seen. Enlightenment does not change things. It just illuminates what is already there. Because the Buddha realized what is already there is a Buddha, is a pearl, is a diamond, all of these images that are used. And sometimes we realize that when everything has fallen away, nothing is being created, and there's not a single thing. Sometimes it's realized when everything has fallen away to reveal one thing that covers heaven and earth, that is universe itself. Suddenly upon contact with water, I understood that the water was neither washing away the dirt nor washing my body. In the midst of this, I became tranquil, and I understood there was nothing there, nothing to grasp, nothing that was me. Nothing that was it. Subject and object are no longer being created in the mind. From a deluded view, we just take subject and object as inherently existing. I look out and I see you, I see a building, I see a tree. They exist in and of themselves. I don't have anything to do with that. So when I'm walking down the street and I see you, and because of the way you look, or the way you dress, or your age, or your size, or whatever, and my mind seizes on that, and I instantly have a warm feeling, or a not liking feeling. That's not you. It's my mind. In a sense, whenever we are injuring, hurting, destroying anything, we're not in contact with that thing anymore. When somebody is hurtful towards another person, they don't see that person anymore. That person has become an object. So mindfulness is developing our capacity to hold an object, one after the next, as they come to us within our awareness and experience it in and of itself. Not my projection, not my association, not my history, not my likes and dislikes, not what I want, the thing in and of itself. So we let go of the discriminating consciousness. That's the judging mind. We let go of the subject. We let go of the meditator. We let go of the one who sees and knows. We let go of letting go. And in actual practice, this kind of works on a path, right? It doesn't happen all at once. And so there's a lot of emphasis on letting go and letting go. But there's still the sense that I am doing this. I have to do this. So we have to let go of the sense of letting go itself, ultimately. Awakening to the basis of water, the footnote says, suddenly their heads are soaked with water. These bodhisattva nuns, I would say not just their heads, but everywhere, there's nothing but water. And so Dogen says, we should study that occasion when the water of the 10 directions is seen in the 10 directions. And it's actually not crazy talk. It's not ultimately poetry. It's not magic. It's really the basic state. And what makes it difficult for us to hear is that we hear it from a reference point. You know, I mentioned on the Fusatsu that when we judge someone else, we judge them according to the standards we have established that are important, which means we're not seeing all the rest that they might be or are, because those standards aren't important to us. So it's very self-referential and reducing. What the Buddha realizes, all things are complete from beginning to end, self-fulfilling, and that's why we can never find ultimate peace or satisfaction or peace or tranquility looking outside. So when we are insecure and we are working so hard to accomplish and achieve and gain and be on top, we can achieve much, we can accomplish much, we can be very successful, but we will never be okay. We'll never be okay with ourselves. That will never happen. It cannot come that way. We have moments, right? I remember when I was performing, you know, and we'd do a performance and I would leave and I'd feel really good about it, and immediately my mind would go, what about the next one? Right? A chef is only as good as their last meal. And so ultimately what this is pointing to is that to know sitting, we have to be sitting. To know Zazen, we have to be sitting in the 10 directions, which means letting go of the idea. It's not just an idea, it's an active self-awareness that our mind creates, that I am encapsulated in this skin. That's the boundary of me. Everything inside is me. That's what I am. Everything outside is not me. That's what I am not. They rise together, the other. But when the mind stops creating, stops producing, stops grasping, in our concentration, in our mindfulness, in our letting go, then we, the sitting, the experience that the person has is that somehow you become larger. But that's not the experience from the inside, right? Because you're not standing outside of it. And so in the sutra, when it says, when the speaker is saying, I realize that I was neither washing away the dirt nor washing my body, that's speaking from the outside. In the moment of realizing the basis of water, they didn't know that. And that's what we're trying to let go of, is that constant self-consciousness, the observer, the witness, the one who stands outside and looks back, or stands here and looks over there. To know walking, we must be walking. To be walking, seeing walking. To know water, to know the basis of water, we must be water, seeing water. Which means we have to let go of the idea, the sense that I am this. In that moment of contact, there is just this. Water sees water. Water watering water. Water practice and verifies water. And so Dogen says, hence there is a study of water speaking water. In that moment of realizing its basis, the intimate language of water was being directly experienced. The intimate language of this self, the true self, is speaking. Not in words. And the footnote says, at that moment, it's no longer anybody's business. How will you understand it? You won't. It's no longer anyone's business because no one's there to observe and narrate and tell a story. I mean, think about how often happens in the Zendo. Something's happening, you're having a great experience, and the first thing you think is, oh, I can't wait to tell somebody about this, right? And then we wax on and on about this incredible story we're going to tell about this incredible experience we're no longer having. Right? It's become an object. It's now a story. It's something we can put on the shelf. That's one of the reasons why in practice, you know, we in Dokusan and face-to-face teaching, we ask the students to not speak about what goes on in there. It's confidential. It's nobody's business. And it's not just, you know, about secrecy. It's not a secret. It's important. And it's also only for the student. And when we start to share it and talk about it, as enjoyable as that can be, it comes apart. The actual experience of it, the memory of it, starts to shift. The commentary talks about how we become confused. People these days also go into bathe. They wash in water. But do they feel this way? Why don't they awaken? It says we're confused and obstructed by the objects of our senses. They stick to our skin and cling to our bones. That's why we don't wake up immediately. When we go into water, we're going into the same water that this bodhisattva walked in. It's the same thing. Why don't we have that same experience, realizing the basis of water, subtle feeling? Because we're not having that subtle feeling. Because we're preoccupied. Because we already know. Because it's just something we have to do to get on to the next thing. Because we're not actually in water. So then water won't speak to us. It's not water's fault. It's not anybody's fault in that sense. It's just the particular workings of the mind. You know, in samsara, the world of clinging and attachments and so on, we overestimate an object's ability or a situation's ability or relationship's ability to bring us ultimate happiness. We overestimate its ability, which leads to disappointment, as the Buddha said, but it also then undermines and helps us sort of prevents us from actually experiencing the actual enjoyment that there is. Because we want more. It should be more. And we underestimate the pain that comes from our attachments. Not so much to those objects, but the desire to have ultimate happiness this way. So when I expect that from you, from a relationship with you, and you don't deliver that, where is my disappointment? Where does it go? When we enter into practice, we underestimate the strength and depth of our attachments and habitual patterns. We think, okay, I've done stuff before. I've done difficult stuff. I've accomplished things. I got this. Sometimes the more accomplished a person is, the more sort of power they have had in their life to make things happen, the harder practice is. Because they think, okay, I got this. This is going to be just like the others. And you know what? It's not. And we overestimate our ability to control our mind, our thoughts, our emotions, our reactions, our outcome. And so we get frustrated. We become discouraged, impatient. The poem, I only need one clear-eyed student who understands this matter. Stretch out your legs on the long bench and lie down. And that's an image that comes up that, you know, after years of training and applying effort and being persevering and courageous, that ultimately we can have the capacity to just stretch our legs on the long bench and relax, truly. In other words, to move with rather than against, to be at ease. The footnote says, after all, they're just a sleepyhead. For eons, they never discuss Chan. So there's sort of a thing about talking about it too much. Teachers, if they talk too much, lose their eyebrows. So I think I'm in trouble. In a dream, you once spoke of awakening to perfect pervasiveness, this bodhisattva who awakened to the basis of water. Why in a dream? Didn't they awaken to reality? So in a dream sometimes is used in the Dharma to speak to the illusions that we create, the magical worlds of our thinking and our concepts, and how we get lost in them. We think they're real. Just like in a dream, everything so seems so real, we react to them like it's really happening. And then we wake up and realize, oh, it's just a dream. And Buddha said, ordinary life, waking life, is a lot like that, actually. But here, this person realized himself. The poem says, in a dream, you once spoke of awakening to perfect pervasiveness. And so, in that sense, the moment we speak of it, we recount it, we go into Doksan, right? And we speak about something. It's not the same as the thing itself. But don't worry, right? The teacher knows that. They're not confused. And there's something that happens when we try to express the inexpressible in a way that isn't defining and nailing it down and solidifying. That's why poetry, that's why pointing to something obliquely, alluding to something, all of these various ways of using language to not define, that when we just try and describe it as accurately as possible, like a real-life portrait, it dies. And so that even in our bringing it forth, it's a dream. I'm dreaming. But there are good dreams and bad dreams, helpful dreams and unhelpful dreams. This is a dream. My teacher in 1980 had a dream of a place where people could train. And he drew other people into his dream. And in a sense, we dream together. That's what a sangha is. We are dreaming together. A good dream. But to know that it's a dream, right? This is a monastery. Where exactly is monastery? This is a sangha. Where exactly is sangha? It's just like the bicycle. It's just like this. There's something there that has enormous potential to serve us well, but to remember, it's a dream. And that's not a diminishment, a denigration. It's an accurate way of seeing it. So why? So we don't grasp. We don't think that this dream is something that has to be preserved. And if you challenge it, I hate you for that. If you don't believe in my dream, then we have a problem. Years ago, there was somebody who was teaching kind of like a rock star. And it was making a lot of heads and tongues waggle. And because they were getting a lot of notoriety and it was a lot of, you know, stuff going on. And so one of the Buddhist journals spoke to Dada Roshi and said, we'd like to do an interview and have you speak about how this rock star teacher is really hurting the Dharma. And Dada Roshi said, this person can't hurt the Dharma. The Dharma is not a thing. Dharma practice is a thing that we do. It's not a thing to grasp onto, but it's something that we do. But the Dharma's not like that. And though you've washed your face in fragrant water, I'll spit right in your face. Well, what's that about? So having washed in fragrant water, having realized the basis of water, having revealed, illuminated through subtle feeling, this transcendent experience. The footnote says, they just went ahead and added layer of mud on top of dirt. In other words, what's been realized, in a sense, is just this. It transforms a life and has the potential to transform lives. And in another sense, it's nothing special. That when we realize self-nature, that doesn't change us. It doesn't elevate us. It doesn't make us better. It's just illuminating. And so he spits in his face or spits in her face to say, what about this water? Is this water less, lower? Right? Do you exclude this water? Are you grasping at the fragrant water? Have you awakened that there is nothing to attach to and then attached to that? So it's a cautionary spit. Done out of love, compassion. Dogen says, therefore, water is not earth, water, fire, wind, space, or consciousness. It is not blue, yellow, red, white, or black. It is not form, sound, smell, taste, touch, or idea. Nevertheless, the water of earth, water, fire, wind, space, and the rest spontaneously appears. It is not anything, and yet, miraculously, it appears. There is no self, and yet, miraculously, and most fortuitously, you have arrived in this life. This being the case, it becomes difficult to explain by what and of what this present land and palace are made. Empty of anything intrinsically existing and yet magically appearing in every moment. And you can think of your thoughts, your strong binding emotions, everything that arises that we think are problematic, you can think of those as miraculous apparitions. We can use them to bind ourselves, we can use them to separate, we can use them to create more self-centeredness, more destructive actions. Or we can put them to good use, to illuminate, to reveal, to mirror back. You know, so think of the very strong currents in our lives that tend to bind us, that we'd like to just be free of. And think of those things as the ways by which we're working out our own path and liberation. Because you can't do it abstractly. We have to be in the water to experience that subtle feeling, that revealed illumination. Dogen says it very beautifully. When the intimate language of water encounters an intimate person, you, the Buddha eye sees the unseen. Our wisdom eye sees what cannot be seen. This intimate action is not known by self or other. It can't be known. The intimate self alone knows it. And that's a different kind of knowing. And that's why these wisdom teachings are pointing us to that mind, that wisdom, and the practice, which is helping us to let the debris and the cloudiness of the water settle. So we can experience that luminous quality. I wanted to thank Kelly for the work that you reiterate what Sekou said this morning, for the work that you were doing with the monastics this week in facilitation training and helping us in developing our right relationship with everything. And I also wanted to thank all the monastics for giving yourself so generously to this week when you had many things to do and to be taken care of that you were leaving behind. And I really recognize that as an act of service, right? Giving, which sometimes, you know, can be inconvenient, right? But is important, right? Because of what it allows us to do. And that you're doing that is for all of us. So thank you for that.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.